Judiciary Committee come to order. We are the inaugural committee in this new Belts Room, and I want to welcome you all here and the members of the committee. We have a quorum to conduct business. It is Monday, January 25th, 2010, and with us today is Senator McGuire, Senator Egan, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We've got two bills on the calendar today. It is the first hearing in this room, so if we have technical issues, we'll just stop, correct them, and go forward. It's not the end of the world. So we'll rely on our trusty staff to wave us down if we get too far ahead of their equipment. But we don't expect any problems, so I'm sure it's going to be fine. So let's go ahead and get started. We have Jane Pearson here from Representative Rammers' office to present House Bill 98, and welcome to the committee, Ms. Pearson. It's always a pleasure. Please put yourself on the record and tell us what your bill does.
For the record, my name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Rammers, and this bill is about minor consuming. There are three types of minor consuming offenses. Minor consuming is the first offense, repeat minor consuming is the second offense, and habitual minor consuming is the third offense. Last year, we put out HB 359, which amended these statutes so that a juvenile would be charged with repeat minor consuming. He or she had to be placed on probation under AS 04-16050B1 or have previously been convicted once. The problem arose that the section included a person who has been convicted of a suspended imposition of sentence under B1 but does not include a person who received a judgment of conviction under B2. B2 imposes a fine of $200 and not more than $600, requires that a person to attend alcohol information school if the school is available, and places a person on probation up to 1 year under E of this section. The court may impose a suspend a portion of the fine that exceeds $200, and the person is required to pay for the education or treatment required under E of the section. It looks like the B2 offenders would be covered under those previously convicted once, but the statute defines previously convicted to exclude a conviction of minor consuming. This means that a minor cannot get convicted of repeat minor consuming if he or she has a judgment of conviction for minor consuming under B2. HB 98 fixes this problem by referencing both the suspended imposition of sentence under B1 and the judgments of conviction under B2, so that no matter how a person is convicted of minor consuming, he or she can be charged with repeat minor consuming. If the bill does not pass, it would be a bit like Bill Murray's Groundhog Day. Anyone convicted under B2 would continue to be charged with minor consuming and could never get to repeat minor consuming. Additionally, the bill removes awkward and confusing language that requires a person having been placed on probation for one of the minor consuming offenses before he and she can be charged with the next higher level offense. This is a good change that does not affect the offenses in any way. The language is a holdover from when a person had to be placed on probation until they were turned 21 years of age. Because this was repealed last year, the probation language remained was confusing and misleading. There was also an amendment that was added in House Finance at the request of Department of Law to fix an issue as it relates to bootlegging. The new language will bring the bootlegging penalties in line with felony DUI penalties, which was the original intent. However, the language was not written that way. And that's it.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Maybe we can just jump to Section 4, since that's the one I was just looking at, the one that deals with the bootlegging penalties, and dispense with them and be finished. Maybe you can just help me, since we're on the fly here, but the language they brought to you or to this, to the bill mm-hmm. in House Finance changed, I guess, what's on line 16, lines 18, and lines 20 to what it is now, right?
True.
And, oh, I see what the problem was. It says 120 days the person has been previously convicted once, but that's not right. It's supposed to be for the first offense.
Right.
Right? And so it didn't really clearly tell you what the bootlegging penalty was for a first offense because it just didn't appear there.
Correct.
As the statute was written before you amended it in House Finance. I see what the problem was exactly. How did that ever get by the eagle-eyed folks in the Senate Judiciary Committee? Hard to imagine. Hard to imagine. Any other questions on this section? And how about the applicability? Maybe we can just flip over to page 4 and tell me what the applicability section does.
Through the chair, the applicability section on page 4, lines 1 through 4, references that an offense occurring on or after the effective date of this act, the references to previous convictions in section 4 of this act apply to convictions occurring before, on, or after the effective date. So if you had been convicted once previously, it would show that it would apply back the next time you were convicted.
It eliminates the possibility of someone misreading how many times you've been convicted by putting this language, having this language operate forward and backwards in time, right?
Through the chair, that's
correct. Prospectively and retrospectively. Mm-hmm. So you can't come back and say, I only have to go, right. I only go to jail for 240 days if I've been convicted twice or more, when it actually it's just once.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, does everybody follow me on that? Just taking on section 4, if you take the B on lines 18 and 19, if you didn't have the applicability section, someone could come into court and say, the statute I was convicted under said I only go to jail for 240 days if I've been convicted twice. But the reality is you go to jail for 240 days if you've been convicted once before. That's what the statute says now, and that's what it's going to say. And it will apply both to cases that have happened before we pass this, like might be happening today, for example, under the law as it's written now, or in the future. Okay. So let's turn then to the minor possession. Section 1, you were explaining before we sat down, Ms. Pearson. Section 1 just has, the only change in Section 1 is the addition of the sentence, minor consuming or in possession or control is not a misdemeanor. And I understand that was just language that was came to the bill on the House floor as a clarification.
Correct.
Was not part of the original bill.
Correct.
Okay. So let's turn to Section 2 then, because that's what you're really getting after. And maybe just walk me through again what the problem was with the way it was written.
Senator French, originally the bill read placed on probation, whereas under B1, they could be granted a suspended imposition sentence, never placed on probation. So therefore, if you are convicted under the B1 part of the statute,
you never step up to the probation aspect. I see. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And has that been, I mean, from your conversations with the Department of Law, has that been popping up in court? They just don't know what to do with the repeat minor in possession offenders?
Chairman French, yes, through the courts, that's been a problem.
Any other questions about Section 2? Okay, let's go to Section 3. Same idea here. A person is guilty of habitual minor consuming or possession of control if the person has a prior conviction. Right, it just gets rid of that problematic was placed on probation language. And that's the only change there. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Any questions about Sections 2 or 3? Any other questions for Ms. Pearson while we have her here? Looks like you've done a great job again. Thank you so much. We'll let you stand down. I'll turn to look and see if we have anybody sign up to testify. And I'm getting the... Oh. Sure, just take. I'll find out. Yep. That's for the next one. That's okay. Right. They're both. Well, Monfreda as well? Let me just ask and see. Ms. Monfreda, are you on the line? Kathy Monfreda?
Yes, sir, I am.
Hi, and are you here? Are you here to answer questions or to testify on HB 98 or SB 222?
I am here to answer questions about SB 222.
Very good. Okay, thank you so much. So there's no one online that wants to testify about HB 98. Anybody in the room that wants to testify? Hearing and seeing none, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony on HB 98, and we will set it aside and carry it over until a future meeting. And timing is actually excellent because we've just been joined by the Attorney General and his Commissioner, and we have the Chief Deputy here for the Department of Law. And let's go ahead and turn now to SB 222, the Governor's Crime Bill, one of the several crime bills presented by the Governor. And I will turn it over to Mr. Zabodny and see who, and the Commissioner, yep, and the Attorney General, yep. See, welcome, welcome. Nice to see you all. Nice to see you. And I will turn it over to you, if you'd be so good for our records, to put yourself on the record,
right.
And I'll let you present this house, whomever you may choose.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Dan Sullivan, and I'm the Attorney General of the State of Alaska. And I have with me here is Joe Masters, Commissioner of Public Safety, and the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, Rick Zabodny. What I propose, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, is give an overview of some of the initiatives, the broader context of this particular bill, and then Joe is going to make some comments, or Commissioner Masters is going to make some comments, and then Rick Zabodny would be focused on a lot of the section-by-section analysis.
Very good.
Great.
Please proceed.
Thank you. And what I first want to do was thank this committee for the opportunity to put this bill before your hearings at a very expedited manner, and we really appreciate that. Know the number of different issues that you're working on, and wanted to at the outset thank you for that, and also wanted to just thank you personally. I've had the opportunity to meet and work with many members of this committee on different issues on this issue, and just wanted to thank you for the spirit of cooperation and collaboration that I've experienced, and I think that's going to be an important element of moving forward on these important matters facing our state. Although, Mr. Chairman, the focus of this hearing is going to be principally on aspects of the bill, the governor's bill, focused on sexual assault and domestic violence, what I thought would be instructive was to provide some of the context of what we've been working on, what the administration has been working on, to try to put forward a comprehensive approach to addressing the sexual assault, domestic violence epidemic that has been ravaging the state of Alaska, our great state, for many years. And although I don't need to describe to this committee, to you, Mr. Chairman, given your focus on this issue, the extent of the problem, the statistics underlying this, I think that the word epidemic is not an exaggeration. And I do think that it's important for all of us, whether in public positions or just the public at large, to remember that every one of these stats has a human life behind it, oftentimes a wrecked human life. And I think that's what we're trying to address today. So, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to mention, at least from the perspective of beginning the Attorney General position appointed back in June. This was the issue that I know I've spoken early on with you, Senator McGuire, others about this issue, and from the criminal part of my responsibilities, the criminal division, this issue has been the absolute number one focus for me and the Department of Law. As you know, we participate in hearings in front of this committee. We've worked with others, we've worked with experts, and over the course of the last several months, studying previous reports, what other states have done, we have tried to put together with the governor's office, the governor, the Department of Public Safety, the Department of Law, a number of related initiatives that, taken together as a whole, we believe provide an important foundation for a sustained, comprehensive approach to addressing the sexual assault, domestic violence epidemic in Alaska. So what I wanted to do is highlight just some of those core initiatives, and then we can get to the bill. First, as the governor mentioned in his, emphasized in his State of the State address on December 3rd, he outlined a broad, comprehensive strategy that focuses on a number of areas, prevention with education, and hopefully you're seeing already being run, the state working in partnership with the network and the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, these Choose Respect ads that we think are the beginning of trying to change the mindset, and we think that's important. Another element of that initiative is on victim services, whether it's funding for more shelters or an initiative the Department of Law is driving right now is to focus on dramatically increasing pro bono services throughout the state for victims. There's actually pretty strong evidence where you have that kind of advocacy that you do start to bring down rates when victims see that the justice system is not some kind of labyrinth but something that can protect them. And then there's also been a focus in that initiative on law enforcement and public safety. The governor mentioned and highlighted the emphasis on increased law enforcement, particularly in rural Alaska. Second, with regard to initiatives and this broader comprehensive approach is what's been proposed in the administration's budget. A number of areas focused on law enforcement, public safety, and with Commissioner Masters here, I would highlight and mention in particular the crime lab that was a key part of the budget, governor's budget. Third, and again, these are related, but new positions that we think are important. So one is a proposed sexual assault domestic violence coordinator that we think will play a very important role in trying to address this and keeping government focused on this. And then last week, again, due to the action of the legislature last year, we announced the hiring and beginning of the new statewide CyberSimes prosecutor. Senator McGuire was good enough to be with us at that event, given your leadership on that. And the focus there is going to be on cyber crimes, but with an emphasis on child pornography issues. And that position's been filled after a nationwide search, and where she started, Marika Athens started that job last week. And fourth, in terms of comprehensive, integrated, sustained aspects of addressing this problem, are different bills, and that's obviously the focus of this hearing today. In addition to this bill, the governor will be also introducing soon bills focused on post-conviction DNA procedures and evidence retention, as well as a bill looking at bail reform. So those will be coming soon, Mr. Chairman, and we'll keep you posted on that hopefully sooner rather than later. What I wanted to do very briefly here was highlight some of the key aspects. I know I've talked to some members of this committee on key aspects of what we see in this proposed bill, and what I wanted to do was emphasize five of those elements that I think are worthy for your attention. The first would be that the bill, if it became law, would prohibit suspended imposition of sentences for people convicted of human trafficking and possession or distribution of child pornography. Second, the bill would make it against the law not just to possess child pornography, but also to access it on a computer with the intention of viewing it. As you know, Mr. Chairman, a recent decision by the Alaska Court of Appeals held that our current law does not prohibit viewing child pornography on a computer. Third, courts under this bill could prohibit sex offenders involving cases with children from using computer using a computer or communicating with children under 16, and that's again to prevent what we see as a big problem in terms of bringing in children in terms of in terms of abuse with regard to attracting children through computers and the internet. Fourth, the bill would provide for enhanced sentencing in the cases with regard to providing aggravating factors when the defendant had knowledge that the victim had consumed drugs and alcohol and was impaired by that. As you know, Mr. Chairman, some of the most heinous crimes that happen here in terms of sexual assault involve cases where the victim was either passed out or under the influence. And finally, the fifth area I wanted to highlight was with regard to sexual assault registration in Alaska. What we would intend to do, what the bill intends to do, is actually close what we've seen as a loophole in the state that allows for certain convicted offenders who have moved up to the state and have had to register in other states to have to register in Alaska. No loopholes. If you had to register in another state, you'd have to register in this state. So, Mr. Chairman, one thing, particularly in your previous position working at the Department of Law, one thing I did want to emphasize was that the ideas in these bills, in this bill, and in the other bills you'll be seeing are really kind of ground-up ideas. So we were getting, the governor, got these ideas and these bills from our frontline prosecutors, from Rick Sabodny and his excellent team at the Department of Law, to look at ways in which they've seen the law has loopholes, to see areas where the law could be strengthened, to do what they do best, which is protect Alaskans and bring criminals to justice. So I wanted to emphasize that because the real experts are here right next to me, as you know. And but these are ideas, initiatives that were really ground up from the troops who are doing the important work day in and day out. I also, as I've done before, when I'm testifying, I did want to mention that with regard to Rick Sabodny and his team and the Department of Law team on the Civil Division, that I just wanted this committee to know, given your particular role with the Department of Law, what an outstanding group of public servants that we have, who work long hours, who are dedicated, who, as you know, Mr. Chairman, work, in positions where, as attorneys, they could, in the private sector, be making a lot more money, but they're dedicated, and it's a great, great team to work with, and I've been in public service most of my life, and these officials are as good as they get in terms of dedication, professionalism, and I just, as the Attorney General, wanted this committee to know that. Finally, just in conclusion, as I mentioned, what we're trying to do here is this bill is a part of a broader, comprehensive, sustained strategy. And we think, as I mentioned at the outset, it's an important foundation, but it's certainly not the gospel truth here in terms of what can work and what can't. So what I wanted to make sure we emphasize today was the importance of continuing, from our perspective, what's been very positive collaboration with this committee on issues that I think all of us really agree on and are focused on, which are to decrease the epidemic of sexual assault and domestic violence in the state, to keep Alaskans safe and protect them, and to bring criminals to justice. And I don't think that there's much disagreement on that, and we're very, very much focused on working with this committee and the rest of the legislature to enhance all the aspects of this initiative, but to make sure that other aspects from recommendations such as senators as yourself are incorporated. So with that, I will conclude my opening remarks.
Thank you. And I just want to say I appreciate you coming down and giving us an overview of the bill. I'm impressed by the energy that the governor's putting into this subject. I'm impressed by the energy that you're putting into it. I want to thank you back. You said some very nice things about our committee and the work we've done in the past. I appreciate that all the people at this table have, you know, taken strong roles in fighting this problem. It's a statewide epidemic, yep. As you say. I don't disagree with anything you've said. And so I just want to thank you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other comments for the Attorney General while we've got him here in front of us? Don't hear or see any. So thank you.
Thank you.
You're absolutely welcome to stay as long as you like. I know you're a very busy person.
Okay, I'm going to listen in a little bit here with your permission and be glad to take any questions. But as you know more than most, Mr. Chairman, the real expert's off to my left here. And I have no problem admitting that.
He is a repository of great repository of knowledge, without question. But thank you.
Sure.
And Commissioner Masters, welcome. If you'd like to say a few words, we'd be happy to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Masters, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. And actually, the AG has done a pretty good job of encompassing a lot of the remarks I had also had prepared for you today. So I'm not going to go through the entire litany of things that the AG has already talked about. I do want to highlight a couple of things, though. And first is that although this committee does not need to hear the numbers again on what this epidemic really is. But I do want to highlight those numbers a little bit. Not necessarily for you, although it's a reminder, but also probably more importantly for the people that are listening in either on this hearing or that will review it later on. And that is, Alaska's number one in the nation for victimization of our women and children in the state. Has been for a long time. And that has got to stop. We're in Alaska 2.5 times more likely, according to the national statistics, to have our women raped than in other states. We're 2.8 times more likely in Anchorage. We're almost 5 times more likely in Fairbanks. Native women in the state are have even higher rates of victimization than that. And I think those that needs to be stated and reminded to the public as well. Even worse, though, is that our children are 6 times more likely to be sexually abused, according to national statistics. And I keep saying national statistics, although I wish we had state statistics of victimization that could give us a pretty good accurate depiction, but we just don't have that in the state, and something that we're working on. The bills introduced or being introduced today, as well as those companion ones, the other ones that the AG has talked about, focus on offender accountability. Changes in the statutes that you're going to be reviewing give law enforcement and give troopers several more tools that they're able to target offenders and perpetrators and hold them accountable for their actions. So I appreciate that, and we truly, I think, can make Alaskans safer as a result of not only the passage of these bills or this bill, but also the passage of the other initiatives that we're talking about pushing forward. So, thank you very much.
You're certainly welcome. It's nice to have you here, and I appreciate you bringing up the subject of victimization. I know it's a something that your department has been working on, getting a victimization survey done. I'm interested in that as well. I think we'll be able to, I've spoken about that to the Attorney General. It's on my radar for this year, and I hope it's something we can get funded to do a good, strong victimization survey and find out just how bad the problem is, because there's always that gap between what's reported to the police and what's actually happening out in the field, and we don't know until we do a survey. So I'm looking forward to working on that with you. Any other questions, comments, or Senator McGuire?
Thank you. Through the Chair, Commissioner, and Attorney General, thank you very much. I'll just briefly say, you know, you've been in this committee many years fighting this issue and responding specifically to this committee's concerns. Thank you. And to the Attorney General for, you know, heeding the call from the meetings that he had with many of us that, you know, if there was a single topic that we would like to see you address as our Attorney General, it would be this topic. And the comments that I've had from people in the public this last week have just been, I would say comments, relief is a word. Just sort of a sense of what took so long, but at least we're here, and relieved to see this administration so focused on this issue. And I know it's complex, and I know it's sensitive, but I feel confident with the two of you and your leadership that we'll move through this next decade, I hope, to continue to, you know, look at eradicating this problem. So just thank you.
Further questions for the commissioner? I don't hear or see anything. Again, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Zabadny, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Zabadny, and I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. I want to thank you at the outset for taking up this bill as one of your first bills, and actually I was very proud to feel like I was going to be one of the first people to testify in the belts room here.
You are. In fact, you are.
And I wanted to be on time, and so I was rushing over from another committee meeting just before this, across the Sky Bridge, and I got off the Sky Bridge there, and I must have looked harried, and kind of a page was there, and I said, "Where's the belts room? Where's the belts room?" And she said, "What?" And I said, "Where's the belts room?" She said, "I'll show you," and she walked me right into the bathroom. So I guess both the pages and the witnesses are a little nervous today.
Or something.
What I want to do is walk through the sectional analysis that I assume you all have. But I want, before I do that, I want to just talk and ask permission of the chair to just describe kind of the order I intend to do this in. Sergeant Derek DeGraff is the expert in cyber crimes, dealing especially with exploitation of children. He, I believe, is in the Capitol building testifying on the issue. But what I would like to do is, if somebody would give me a nod at like 2:30, he'll be here around then. And even if I'm not done with the leave of the chair, since he won't be here after 3, or he'll be here after 3, but he won't fit with your schedule, that he'll just take my place and then I can come back, or somebody else can go through the sectional analysis.
That makes sense.
Okay. I'm going to, starting with sections 1 and 2 at page 1, lines 8. Before I get there, let me just say it was nice praise from my boss about the work we do, but I have been in contact with many states, both on the procedures that people use in the criminal prosecution and the statutes that we are given as tools to use in criminal prosecution. And I may have contacted 25 experts across the state, and they are always very surprised about the tools that you as the legislature have given us in the area of sexual assault and domestic violence. Dealing with some of these experts, they say that they're the best laws that they've seen in the country. That doesn't mean that there aren't tweaks to them. In Section 1 and 2 of the bill are what I would call a tweak. And I would ask leave of the chair to call Mike Stark to sit beside me and describe the reasons for this tweak and the problems it's causing the parole board. Basically, what sections 1 and 2 do is to remove the words, remove parole, discretionary parole, from the language of statutory change you made in 2007. And I'm not saying you putting the blame on this committee or anybody. The Department of Law made the same mistake, I think, that the legislature made, and it's had a little bit of an unanticipated consequence. So,
Mr. Stark, he's welcome to come forward. It's nice to see him as well. Welcome.
Thank you.
Make yourself comfortable, introduce yourself to the committee, and we'll receive your wisdom.
Thanks very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Stark. I serve on the Alaska Board of Parole. This is my ninth year on the board. Prior to that, I worked in the Attorney General's office for 27 years, the last 22 as lead counsel to the Department of Corrections, and the last 15 as counsel to the Parole Board. And so at this time, I guess I'm a recovering attorney serving on the board, not as an attorney, but as a member of the board. Just very briefly, an overview. I think probably all of you don't understand the difference between probation and parole as perhaps the chair does because of his prosecution experience. But very briefly, probation is when the court sentences somebody and suspends part of the sentence. So, for example, give somebody a 6-year sentence with 2 suspended. So they have a 4-year sentence to serve. There's 2 years hanging over their head when they get done serving that 4-year sentence. And then the court puts that person on probation for a period of time, up to 10 years for all offenses except sex offenses, and up to 25 years for sex offenses. One of the tools you gave Mr. Sabodny, and the courts ought to help combat sex offenses. So they'll be on, probationers will be on supervision for up to a very long period of time, and will have over their head during that period of time to make sure they're complying with their probation conditions, the suspended portion of their sentence, in my example, 2 years. Parolees there are two kinds of parolees. The far and away the large number of parolees are called mandatory parolees. Those are persons who have a sentence to serve of 2 years or longer. and they get, all offenders get good time, with some few exceptions, get good time off their sentence, one-third off. And so the amount of the good time they've earned in a two-year sentence, for example, one-third off would be 8 months. So they would serve 16 months, and they would serve the 8 months they got in good time on the street when they get released as a mandatory parolee. And that situation would actually be on probation and parole at the same time. Mm-hmm. Parole typically would expire before probation, but not always. Discretionary parolees, which are a small number, they're the stereotypical kind of people that perhaps you've seen in movies, I've been good, let me out early. You know, and there's some of those, not a lot, and they do far and away better on the street because they're out as a discretionary decision of the parole board and not as a matter of law like mandatory parolees. So when the legislature adopted this criminal statute, 1156-759, which Section 1 and 2 address, it was really intended, and I rely on Mr. Sabani for this, but it really intended to deal with the probation situation, where because of the long period of probation supervision that now exists, particularly for sex offenders, let's say you have a handful of years hanging over their head. If they violate their probation and the court imposes all that time, yet there still is more time on probation supervision, well, what do you use as an incentive to get probationers to comply with their conditions since you don't have any more jail time over their head? So this statute created a new crime for probationers and parolees who violate their probation or parole. It's a new misdemeanor offense, and they can get up to a year in jail. And so that makes perfect sense in the probation situation, where they may still have a long period of supervision ahead, even, and all their suspended time has been served. Parolees, on the other hand, once they've served all their time and their supervision time, they don't have anything left. So this really wasn't intended to get at them. It really was, and as often the case over the years, probation and parole are treated similarly, and I think got thrown in at the last minute, include parole too, without somebody really thinking it through. And, you know, so big deal, you know, no harm done. Except, and we didn't really find this out until afterwards, there was a fairly serious unintended consequence of this. As I'm sure you all know, if you've talked to anybody who supervises sex offenders on the street, as I do all the time dealing with probation parole officers, the best way to keep track of these people is make sure you're having frequent and probing conversations with them, because their behavior, as we all know, is underground behavior. It's manipulative. That's how they create new victims. So you want to know what they're doing all the time. And you do that by not only checking up on them, but talking with them and double-checking, not taking their word for it, making sure they're telling the truth. They're not cruising the malls, for example, looking for new victims, if that's the nature of their offense, and so on. And what's happened here, because now if they're charged with a violation of parole, for example, taking a drink, if their sex offense was any way related to substance abuse, the parole board will have a condition that they can't drink. And if their violation is they got caught taking one drink, they now face the possibility of prosecution under this new misdemeanor statute because they violated their parole. Well, because of that, attorneys representing these folks in before the parole board, and I should tell you that no one's ever been prosecuted for it, but the potential is there. And so the attorneys are telling these guys, stop talking to your probation officer, your parole officer, and don't say anything to the parole board when you come before them. So all of a sudden, the necessity of having all these in-depth conversations, and I can assure you, when we have people across the table from us, when the parole board conducts hearings, we're not constrained by the rules of evidence like the judges. So we ask very hard questions. I'm closer to you, Mr. Chair, to the parolees than we are today when we have these hearings. And we ask very hard questions, and we don't let them slide. They answer us, or they face the consequences. But now, all of a sudden, their attorneys are advising their clients not to talk to us, not to talk to their officers, because they could potentially be prosecuted. So no one thought that somehow having this new statute was actually going to increase the risk to the public. But that's really what's happened, because all of a sudden we don't know what these people are doing because they're not talking anymore because of their Fifth Amendment.
Let's turn to Senator Wilkowski for a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You said that you ask them hard questions, and if they don't answer the questions, they face the consequences. But it doesn't sound like there are any consequences. What are their consequences?
Well, The typical situation is a mandatory parolee who, whatever period of good time they've earned, and it can be years. I mean, if it's a long sentence and they finally get out, they have a period of years on parole. So if they're charged with a parole violation, we could revoke up to that entire period of time, put them in prison. The thing is, if they really are making an effort, you know, they're doing sex offender treatment, they're doing everything that they're supposed to do, they're trying to be good citizens, we don't want to put them in jail for no reason. I mean, for taking a drink, maybe that's not the right solution. You require them to go to treatment, you may put them in a halfway house for a period of time, but we also want to find out what they're doing in terms of their other behaviors. Make sure this is just a drink, and it's not, you know, they're not creating new victims or starting back into their assault cycle.
So if you ask a question and someone says, I exercise my Fifth Amendment rights and I refuse to answer that question, what can you possibly do at that point? Could you go to court and ask for a revocation?
Well, no. See, we actually have the authority to revoke the good time. We don't have to go through the court.
Unilaterally, you could. So if someone didn't answer the question, you could go ahead and revoke.
But no? We have to be careful because they do have a Fifth Amendment right. And the question relates to, because of this statute, essentially, any parole violation subjects them to criminal liability, the potential for criminal prosecution. Just for taking a drink, they could be convicted by the court if the prosecutor were to charge them under the existing statute, the way it reads today. And you know, it's a balancing. Obviously, these people at some point are going to be out in the street. So you balance. You know, we can put everybody in prison as long as we can. But when that's all done, what do we have? Somebody coming out. Have we worked with them? Have we put them through the programs that are going to hopefully reduce the risk? Or have we just played hardball with them and they're angry and they're going to get out and we're much more likely to see new victims? Mm-hmm. So we're balancing that. And because of this statute, because the attorneys and their ethical obligation to their clients saying, I recommend you don't say anything anymore because you could be charged with a new crime. Because of that, we don't have the ability to communicate with offenders, sex offenders, the way we did at one time. And it was very effective. And
Senator Wilkowski, do you have a follow-up?
Well, I'm a little confused. I mean, it sounds to me like if someone's not cooperating, you just revoke. Am I missing something, Mr. Savani?
And if I could, through the chair.
Yeah, please.
We can always do that. But let me ask you this. I don't like to respond to a question with a question, but so it's... If we're faced with somebody that has quite a period of time on supervision and they're charged with a minor technical violation, drinking was one example. If they have a curfew, missing the curfew by a short period of time, something that really in and of itself is not a great risk to the public. But to get their attention, the officers charged them and brought them before the board. If they are open and they can communicate clearly to us that they really are making an effort at rehabilitation, they are not trying to create new victims, and we believe them, then, you know, we may give them a slap on the wrist, we may give them a stern warning, we may put them in a halfway house for a period of time, make them go through treatment, whatever, but it doesn't make sense to put them back in prison. I mean, that's very expensive to the state, taking up a hard bed by somebody who really doesn't present a risk. Our problem is our options are somewhat limited if we're not able to talk with these people and really get a strong feel for the risk. We can always put everybody back in prison, but in the long term, is that serving the public? And that's the question we ask ourselves.
Let me ask if I could. So this section one,
it's one
section
and two.
Right. The sense I'm getting, the theme I'm getting is that it's you're making this change because of the Fifth Amendment issues that arise due to the fact that you're charging parolees with new crimes for having violated the conditions of their probation.
Well, they're not even being charged. They haven't even been charged, but they could be.
Okay.
And it's largely the Public Defender Agency who we deal with, you know, certainly some private counsel.
Right.
But they're saying in good conscience they have to recommend to their clients that they not say anything.
So how does just striking parole from here fix your problem if it's the same issue with respect to probation?
Oftentimes, if it's a minor violation, the probation parole officer, will only bring it before the board. They won't go to the courts, for example, unless it's real serious. Mm-hmm. And then they want to hammer them with both the suspended mm-hmm. time on the probation and the parole time. Mm-hmm. And we certainly see that. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes, because the board is administrative, it's much easier. Mm-hmm. Our calendar works more effectively. They bring us, they want to get their attention, their offender's attention. They'll bring it before the board and not the court.
Mm-hmm.
And if we take parole out of the picture, and oftentimes people aren't on probation as well as parole. Sometimes they are. And sometimes we're going to have the problem. If they are on probation and the attorney says, because you know you still could be prosecuted on the probation level, don't say anything. That's not going to totally cure it, but it certainly will help it quite a bit because of what we see before the board.
Would it be fair to say that you're trying to preserve some sense of flexibility in dealing with parolees?
Absolutely. And to serve our, which we view as our primary responsibility, which is protecting the public,
mm-hmm.
while trying to work with the offender and help them rehabilitate themselves.
So because many violations go straight to the parole board without having to file a formal petition to revoke probation, the ones that we would see in court,
right.
And because that's now, because violating a condition of parole has now become a substantive crime in its own right, setting aside all the hammering you can get for the parole time you've accumulated,
mm-hmm.
Public defenders are advising their clients not to cooperate with their parole officers.
And they've been doing it for the last 2.5 years.
Since this got put on the books.
Yes.
I see.
July 1, 2007, and we would actually be able, not every time, but certainly from time to time, actually get sex offenders who were making an effort to actually open up and talk about unreported victims, which nobody even knew about until they came before the parole board because of the probing questions that we asked them and when they weren't facing criminal prosecution for that information.
It may be Senator Egan has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just... when these folks appear before the board, are they represented by counsel all the time?
They can waive the right to counsel, but because they face the potential for going back to prison, they have the right to counsel, and frequently they are represented, more often than not.
And more often than not would be a public defender.
Yes.
It may be worth turning to Quinlan Steiner, who I see is on the line, unless you have more for us, Mr. Stark.
No.
Further questions for Mr. Stark? Let's go ahead and ask Mr. Steiner if he can hear me. Get him on the line. We can just do this sort of point by point instead of waiting for an hour longer to find out his perspective on the measure. Mr. Steiner, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
If you go ahead and put yourself on the record, and if you've been following discussions, you can jump in and tell us your view of Sections 1 and 2 of SB 222.
My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. Just in response to Sections 1 and 2, I think the effect of those two provisions are as described. By removing that language, it would remove some potential in some situations to make a Fifth Amendment claim, and that would free up, I suppose, an opportunity to ask questions or eliminate the advice about when or is not a Fifth Amendment claim on those particular questions.
And I know you're past representing individual clients, but Mr. Stark tells us that your folks in your shop have been advising parolees not to answer questions for fear of future prosecution. Are you aware of that going on?
I'm aware that after discussions with clients, some of our attorneys will, in fact, advise their clients that they have Fifth Amendment claims with respect to certain questions.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we change this law, would parolees still be potentially incarcerated for admitting crimes during these discussions with their parole officers, probation officers? In other words, you're having a you're saying that we need to remove this because if they admit to crimes, or they won't admit to crimes because they could potentially be jailed for them. Or prosecuted for them. If we change this, if someone admits a crime to their parole or probation officer, I mean, couldn't they still go to jail for that?
Yeah, broadly speaking, potentially, it would provide evidence. This eliminates this particular offense. If you were to admit a specific conduct that could be charged under this statute, then you would have a Fifth Amendment claim. Broadly speaking, admitting criminal conduct could potentially subject you to a criminal charge, but this just deals with that particular statute of committing a violation of your parole or probation.
Mr. Steiner, hang on one second. Mr. Stark wants to jump in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could respond, it's not the admission of a crime that we're trying to deal with. Anytime they admit to a crime, if it's serious, I support prosecuting the individual. It's the otherwise innocent behavior. It's a non-criminal behavior. I had a drink. I violated my curfew.
I
did some other technical violation. So when they are charged with that, they stop talking, period. So we don't know where these people are, for example. We don't know if they're cruising a mall and might present a risk in that situation. We don't know if they're having contact with minors because they're visiting their sister's house and there's young children there, because they won't talk anymore to their officer on their attorney's advice. It's the innocent kind of behavior, the non-criminal behavior that they're not communicating anymore, that is key in being able to supervise them on the street.
Senator Lukowski.
I'm missing something here, because if someone admits to violating their curfew or speaking with children when they're not supposed to, that's a crime, right?
I mean, no, it's not a crime. It's a violation of parole. It would subject them to the possibility of the parole board revoking their good time and putting them back in jail. Yes, but it's not a crime in and of itself.
And you're saying under this law, once they made that admission, I was 5 minutes late for my curfew, then that is a crime for which they have to be.
It potentially subjects them to prosecution under this statute as it exists on the books today. And we want to pull parole out of there so that it doesn't cover that kind of behavior anymore for parolees. Yes.
So, Mr. Chair,
please.
So if we make this change, then we're taking away the potential criminal violation, but they could still have their parole or probation revoked, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And it would increase the ability to monitor these people on the street, and that's our primary concern.
Just remind me when we put this law in the books, this law of sort of, it's always been, when you violate your probation, you go back to jail for a probation violation. Now we've made it a separate, subsequent, standalone crime.
And Mr. Sabani is probably best suited to respond.
Sure.
I think, yes, Mr. Chairman. What happened was, I think it was 2006, there was a substantial increase in the penalties for sex offenses, including the ability to put somebody on probation up to 25 years. So what was envisioned is what happens if somebody gets a 50-year sentence with 10 years suspended. And they're put on probation for 25 years. So it's a sex offender. We want them to be monitored. They do their 40, 50 years. They flat time the sentence, or they get out on probation and they get revoked. So they've done the total amount of their sentence, all 50 years. There's no time left. And yet they still have 25 years of probation that didn't go away under this 2006 amendment. What do we do with them? What sanction is there for having somebody who's still on that type of probation? What's the sanction to keep them in sex offender treatment?
So it's aimed at people for whom there is no more suspended time hanging over their heads.
That's right.
Okay, and all parolees, not all parolees, but the vast majority have suspended time in addition to their parole time. You rarely get a flat 6-year sentence for a sex crime. You're going to get 10 years with 4 suspended.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any more questions on this section? And if not, that's perfect, because Mr. DeGraff has joined us, and we can shift, and it is about 2:30. Mr. Stark, thanks so much for being here. Yep, I think we're finished. Thank you. And we'll invite Mr. DeGraff up and switch gears. Welcome to the committee. Hi. Go ahead and put yourself on the record. Tell us who you are, and refer us to the bill section you're going to address, and we'll go from there.
My name is Derek DeGraff. I'm a sergeant with the Alaska State Troopers. I supervise our technical crimes unit, which is essentially a cybercrime unit within the Alaska Bureau of Investigation. We're part of the Alaska Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force to combat child exploitation on the Internet. We also process most electronic evidence, most devices seized within the state for evidence such as computers, cell phones, digital cameras, that sort of thing. I'm here to address some questions you may have regarding the child pornography aspect of the law.
Very good. Oh, welcome to the committee. Let's go ahead and turn to those sections. If you can orient us, or Mr. Zabotny can tell us which parts we're looking at, we'll go there.
Mr. Chairman, at page 3, line 20, we start with sections 5, 6, and 7.
3, line 20. I see it. Yep, 5, 6, and 7. Very good. Maybe, Mr. Zabotny, you want to tell me what they do, and then Mr. DeGraff can tell us how it's going to work on the ground.
Recently, the Alaska Court of Appeals decided a case, Warden versus State, which where a person was convicted of having child pornography in the cache memory of their computer. So the question was, did the person just view child pornography on their computer, or did they do something to store it? And Sergeant DeGraff can go into an explanation about cache memory, but cache memory didn't indicate that they had exercised some type of dominion or control, according to the Court of Appeals, over the child pornography. So, in essence, it brought to light that our statute for possession of child pornography on a computer would require more than just viewing the child pornography, but exercising some type of dominion or control. And these changes change our law to be similar to the federal law, where not only is it against the federal law to possess child pornography, but it's also against the law to view on a computer child pornography. So given that change, we also create an affirmative defense, because some people may have accidentally downloaded child pornography. They probably didn't do it, if they did it once, they probably didn't do it twice, but or three times. But it allows for an affirmative defense if there's less than three indications of downloading child pornography, that they can either delete it themselves without showing it to others, or contact the police showing it to them so it can be removed from their computer. By that last statement, I didn't mean to say that the police are going to become the computer cleanup people for the state, but it would allow somebody to have an affirmative defense if it turned out that we couldn't show that they were also possessing it. So it tracks federal law on downloading child pornography.
Senator Wilkowski.
So someone sends you an email, you open the email, there's child pornography in the email. That's not knowingly accessing on a computer.
Well, first, that wouldn't be possession, nor would it be that you knowingly had it, child pornography, until once you had it, and then what do you do with it? If you destroy it, there's an affirmative defense here.
And where's that?
That's the last section, section 7.
Possessed or accessed less than three depictions?
Right.
Okay, so someone sends me an email, or you get a virus, you open up the email, there's pornography in the email, you're protected under section 7.
Correct.
If you open it up three times or four times, you lose the protection.
Through the chair, what we did was we took the federal law on that, and I don't know if there's a magical number that's three that you ought to have learned by three, or if it's three strikes you're out. But we modeled that after the federal law. In my mind, although you have the expert sitting next to me, you know, there's nothing magical about three, but there is somewhere that you draw a line. If it's 25, I would think that you would be saying that we've moved on from an accident to intentional viewing.
Senator Wilkowski.
And I know what you're trying to get at, completely supportive of it. We have on our desks, I don't know where it came from, but I remember reading this article. It's just horrifying. It's viruses that put computer porn on your computer. And I just want to make sure that we're protecting innocent people out there who have viruses put on their computers or sent emails with these kind of things. That's my only concern. And are you feel that there are adequate protections in this bill for that?
Through the chair, and you need to ask Sergeant DeGraff about this, but a complete forensic analysis in this state, I know the article you're referring to, is done before we're prosecuting these people. So we ought to be catching it up front as opposed to charging somebody and then they're coming forward with an expert and showing that it came through a virus. You have to knowingly view and then if it turns out that you're repeatedly doing that, you have to do something to get the affirmative defense by getting it off your computer. And I think this is where I should be quiet and turn to the expert.
Yeah. Sergeant DeGraff, do you want to answer the senator's question?
Yes, through the chair.
Please.
There's different scenarios that can happen to cause child pornography to be on somebody's computer. The most common that we see in law enforcement are those that are purposefully going out, downloading software. Typically, it's called file sharing software. The software name is LimeWire. You might have heard of it. I do a lot of presentations, and I bring that up in these presentations, and parents kind of stiffen up a little bit because they realize, holy cow, my kid has it on their computer because they're getting free music on the internet. And you might have seen some of the articles with the feds going after them for music rights violation. That's the most common thing that we are seeing within law enforcement. That's the number one way child pornography is being shared throughout the world. Law enforcement is able to proactively go after these people because what they are doing is essentially advertising and sending out child pornography, sharing it with anybody else with the same software anywhere in the world. So we can download child pornography from these folks, give us our probable cause to go to their house and interview them, talk to them, seize their computers. That's the bulk of the cases we work. The other cases are when you have the 10-year-old that goes to the school counselor and says, you know what, my mom's boyfriend's been showing me these horrible photos and movies on the computer for the last 2 months, and I finally got the courage to tell somebody about it. We go interview the child, go to the house, develop a probable cause, seize computers, interview folks, corroborate that sort of a scenario. Those are the two primary ways we end up at somebody's house to investigate allegations of possession or distribution of child porn. I've read that article, and it's somewhat misleading based upon real facts that I've seen throughout the community of forensic examiners and law enforcement that do this sort of thing. But the scenario does exist where somebody could inadvertently end up on a child pornography site or enter a search term in Google that might, and they have their filters off, that might give them a page that's showing them images of child pornography. One of the things that we have to be careful with when we interview complainants is their definition of child pornography as offensive as an 18-year-old female being some sort of lewd exhibition, sexual act, something like that, might be to somebody. That's not child pornography within the Alaska statutory framework that's laid out for us to investigate these cases. Child pornography is essentially the cases that we go after are pictures or movies of prepubescent children being sodomized or raped or photographed, and those types of images or movies are being shared. And those are the types of cases we find ourselves working and investigating. It's not the Girls Gone Wild type pop-up ads that some people will rightfully so knee-jerk react and say, I've got child porn on my computer. Those are the typical scenarios that we see as in law enforcement. It's fairly easy, as I'm a forensic examiner, a computer examiner, to figure out what people are doing on the internet. They have viruses. We have tools that tell us this sort of thing, software. We can see when people log in. We can corroborate with other witnesses, people in the house, who's on the computer, who uses the account, is it password protected. And we can do a pretty good job of figuring out if somebody was purposefully keyword searching, logging into websites, paying for memberships online from some site in Russia to download child pornography. I've seen a couple cases since I've been doing this for about 5 years where somebody, in my opinion, inadvertently got child pornography on their computer. They didn't report it, but it kind of came up somehow, and we didn't pursue them. And this is before this protection is enacted, because it's the reasonable thing to do. But most of our investigations end up, you know, the number one goal that we have, if we have a tip that somebody in this house has child pornography, is we have to figure out who's behind the computer and the intent. That's what this law mirrors after the federal law here. So I think it's a great framework. The feds have adopted this because of this loophole. But I've seen cases that we have not prosecuted in Alaska because somebody, I can have a suspect confess that they were viewing child pornography through their web browser, and if they were not purposefully saving it to the hard drive, we have to walk away. Are they any less of a predator than somebody that's sharing them? You know, that's for somebody probably smarter than me to answer, but we know based upon the studies, 20 to 80% of people that collect these images and movies will offend or have already offended on a child. And so our goal here is to protect the children through this law. It gives us a little more teeth to go after the worst of the worst.
Senator McGuire.
Well, sorry.
Okay. Through the. You're waiting. Were you finished? I'm sorry. Okay.
Through the chair. Thank you. Thank you for the work that you do. I'm just curious if back when I was in the House, I put a bill in that allowed for the for law enforcement to seize the hard drive and the software, all of the instruments of the crime, if you will, in these cases. And I think it was in 2002 or 3. It was early on. My question is it working as a tool? Are there places you think that it needs to be expanded in the forfeiture part of it? And sorry, I'm going outside perhaps the scope of this line of questioning, but it just struck me as I was thinking about what you do day and day. And the thought was that you could, again, continue to learn through the criminals what was happening, that you know, to retrace their steps.
Through the chair, it's been wildly successful. In my opinion, I've been to lots of training, thousands of hours of training, and what the Alaska State Troopers has is the best of the best technology that's out there and available to us. It just kind of comes down to how many people you have working these sort of cases, but I don't think there's other laws. I don't think there's anything that need to be added that would give us, arm us better with different technologies or procedures. We already have it. It's going very well.
Good. And just if I might, through the chair, are you able to seize the equipment though? There's been no problem in seizure.
There's been no problem.
Okay.
Senator Coghill.
Just two things. First of all, just to go back to the cash question, since Mr. Sobotny brought it up, the issue is that they would view it and it just gets loaded to their computer without them purposefully saving it. Is that what I understand the caching is?
Just through the chair, that's exactly correct.
Okay. Then the other question was, we had the demonstration before, I think a joint committee on the cyber crimes unit, just targeting issues, and it seemed to me like in that conversation, resources to you were inadequate compared to the issue going on in Alaska. Has there been some improvement in that? Do these laws help you with better tools for those resources? Kind of give me a scope of where we're at.
Yeah. Through the chair, it was about a year and a half ago. There was a House bill, some legislation that came forward that actually funded an investigator for my unit, as well as an evidence technician. And we've hired people and used those two, been wildly successful with that as well. Our cases have more than doubled in the last year that we were able to proactively go after. You're probably referring to Flint Waters.
Yes, right.
From Wyoming.
That's
that came
right
here.
Yes.
In fact, I just got back Saturday from updated training from that exact technology. Would it hurt to have more people doing this? Absolutely not. We work maybe within the ICAC, we probably proactively work about 20 cases a year statewide. Anchorage Police Department does about half of them specifically within the Anchorage Bowl, mm-hmm. and the Alaska Bureau of Investigation does them statewide. I've been to Wrangell, been to Barrow, Bethel, all over the place working these cases. So to specifically answer your question, yeah, we could certainly do better with more, but based upon Flint Waters' discussion here, we have used and implemented that technology. It's growing leaps and bounds. It's phenomenal what we're able to do and track people within Alaska and see what they're doing online and then go after them.
Mr. Chairman, I think probably about three high-profile cases the last year, I think. So that should put people on notice that we're doing it. I was just probably the most sobering demonstration I think I've seen in my entire time in the legislature, and I could not get away from
the real-time demonstration of what was going on in Alaska, plus the magnitude. It was just, it just floored me. So I just thought I'd ask. And, looks like we got more to do.
No, it's a great point. Many of us attended that presentation. It was shocking, to say the least. And just parenthetically, I think I made it known to the committee, but we are trying to arrange a field trip to your base of operations so we can come and see, you know, there in the room when you're working on this, what it's like to engage in this process. And we're looking forward to
that. Love to have you.
Looking forward to that. Let me ask you just a couple questions. And I guess it's just worth saying that, at least from my perspective, this is necessary. I look at the newspaper. I read the newspaper online. If I had the newspaper in my hands, no one would doubt that I'm possessing the newspaper. But for some reason, my looking at the newspaper online, I'm not possessing it, at least in the way that the statute says so. So, you know, I think this is a tool you've got to have at some level. I guess I never realized that you had to sort of store something on your computer to be perceived as possessing it. At least that's the line of thought that the Court of Appeals took. And, you know, that's fine. But I just want to ask, back on the statute and language that we're going to adopt, Section 5, I see we're defining computer, but not accesses. And while we're making a good record here, maybe this question may be more for Mr. Zabotny than for you, Sergeant DeGraff, but do we feel confident that a web cached page, if I'm using that phrase correctly, is accesses? You know, is there any chance that we're going to get all through this rigmarole and have the court say, well, that's not accessing, that's something else?
I might be able to start.
Sure.
Start answering. You could follow up. So far, this is the best language we've seen. The feds have adopted it, and we've taken the approach because of the Ninth Circuit and some of the strange decisions that they have in trying to get the strongest, most accurate language. Could this change in 5 years because of some nuance or new technology? Mm. Sure. Mm. We might be here again then. But right now, I think, based upon our discussions and research, it is the best.
Within your sort of collective area of expertise, accesses means looked at on a computer page.
Yes.
Okay. That's I guess, let's walk through it. Senator Wilikowski.
What would be the upside or downside of changing accesses to views? I mean, does not perhaps clear up some of your concerns?
Through the chair, actually, when there was the discussion with the chair and Sergeant DeGraff, I thought, why not use view access? But
right.
That's the lawyer response.
Right.
Somebody would say, well, this is different now if you've added view and access. You mean something different than what the Ninth Circuit means. And if we're okay there, we've got to be okay almost any place.
I'm sorry. Ninth Circuit
Court of Appeals.
Accesses is the magic word to use.
Through the chair. The feds adopted this language because they felt it was the most accurate and that it would stand up in federal court. So that's why we're modeling it. I don't know that a case has come before them and they've put their stamp of approval on it. We just right now, it's the best that we have, and it could certainly change.
I'm just thinking out loud, and this bill's not leaving the committee today. We're making a slow but very thorough progress on it, but it is going to take. It's going to be here for a subsequent hearing, and I don't know. I guess you've got to prove knowing. I guess you know, it all goes back to the many other aspects of the circumstances that surround the control of the computer and the passwords and so forth. But it may be easier to prove that it was accessed because there's the cyber proof on the hard drive or somewhere in the cache that it was accessed. And proving that it was viewed may be a harder thing to prove. Did the person actually view it? I don't know, but he accessed it because there's the proof on his in his web cache.
The interestingly enough, Microsoft and Apple, the two names that they use and file attributes are, there's a created date, a modified date, and an access date in both operating systems. An access just means, doesn't necessarily mean viewed. It means something got a hold of that file and accessed it.
Pulled it into this IP address.
Pulled it into this program to be viewed, manipulated, right. Or sent or emailed. So it could be that they're modeling over what computers actually categorize these files, one of the file attributes.
We may wind up putting an or views in there. You know, it just may be that, you know, you know, because, for example, what if a person's good at, you know, going in there and cleaning out his cookies and his web cache and all that stuff, and yet you've got, you know, sort of incontrovertible proof from a child or from a strange spouse or something, that guy's been sitting in that room looking at child pornography. I've seen him do it 10 times, you know, but it, you know, but you can't capture it on the computer. Go ahead.
Good point, because actually if someone was sitting at their computer and they had a group of friends over and they did this on a regular occasion, the people who are standing around looking at it aren't prosecutable under this, correct? They haven't accessed it. They've viewed it, but they
through the chair, you know, it does go down to the big picture, the circumstance of the report, but I think the key is there is knowingly. You know, we've had reports that come in, one recently down in on the Kenai, where somebody was, a gentleman was showing off his child pornography collection to somebody else. That other individual ended up turning in his friend. Did he, you know, knowingly access the computer? I would say he didn't knowingly. His friend showed him, but he did access the computer and or viewed it. So I think those two words tied together is the strongest language that we have right now.
Well, we'll take that into consideration. But and this topic we're touching on, I think, will come up in other portions of the bill. But it is, you got to be careful not to make it a crime to have someone, you know, I mean, how gross is that? How stupid is it? It's, you know, it's crazy, but you walk into someone's room, he says, hey, I want to show you something, and suddenly you've seen something that's horrible. It's against the law, but, you know, are you a felon for that if you, you know, are, you know, turned away and disgusted? I don't know. But it's, but here we are, right in the middle of it. Questions for Senator Coghill?
Just to pursue it further, it seems to me, I'm not real computer literate, but you have to click something to make something happen, generally. And there have been times where inherent in some programs, you know, something pops up and says you got to do this. So does your access then follow on some action that they have to take, or is it, could it be something that's running in the background? I've even heard, and now I'm getting into the conspiracy theory problem, but that some people can even use your computer if you leave it online and you allow it to run online without the proper firewall. Somebody can access your computer and use it. Are those possibilities?
Through the chair, those are certainly possibilities within the realm of, you know, real life. They're rare, but it kind of goes back to the whole picture and the forensic examination.
Knowingly,
and you have to show beyond, you know, probable cause, beyond reasonable doubt, that somebody actually knowingly accessed it. You know, we've had cases where we show up to somebody's house because of a tip or lead, and in fact, that happened here in Juneau last year. Gentleman had a wireless router, unsecured, no password. We show up, his IP address was the one tracking him. His account showed dominion and ownership over the computer. Based upon his interview and on-scene analysis that we do, we showed that it was actually somebody else accessing his wireless router. We explained everything at the end. He was very thankful to us. We helped him secure his wireless router, and we left, and that was the end of it. So there is a balance between showing up at somebody's house and making accusations, kicking the door in, and then going in and just talking to people as people, figuring out what happened. But we certainly have to keep an open mind, and something I stress with our folks is, just because we have a tip or a lead that says somebody at this house did something, it may not be the homeowner. It could be the 40-year-old son that lives in the basement with no windows, or it could have been somebody, a neighbor, accessing their unsecured wireless modem, or it could be something else. So those are all things we have to take into consideration.
Okay. Further questions?
Electrons floating everywhere.
Mm-hmm. I think, is there anything you'd like to conclude with, Sergeant?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, if I may, there are two other provisions of the bill that deal with kind of this, the same subject, that maybe we should take up before he, takes off.
If you direct us to them, that'd be a good idea.
Page 4, line 12, starting at section 8, 9, and 10. And what this, actually, I think we got carried away with Flint Waters and his examination. We made it a crime to, where you made it a crime to, probably at my request, you made it a crime to show child pornography, to send child pornography to somebody to a child over the internet.
Point of order, and this is important because my staff and I were discussing this before we came down here. Section 8, we're not talking about child pornography.
I'm sorry, you're correct. You're talking about indecent...
Let's call it ordinary pornography. Ordinary, which doesn't make it any better, but let's just, I mean, for the purposes
ordinary
of...
Ordinary pornography, yeah, yeah. That's correct. They're the things that are listed. Adult pornography.
There you go.
But we made it a crime to send adult pornography to children.
To children,
well,
right.
We forgot. Mm. Is sending them that pornography by mail, showing them a movie, any other way that you could distribute the pornography to children. So this would say, not only can you not do it over the internet,
interesting,
you can't do it.
What? And forgive me, that's not covered by contributing to the delinquency of a minor?
Well, actually, it might be, which is generally to cause a child to commit a crime, be absent from the home, not go to school. I'll have to take a look.
It might, right.
But even if it's there, even if it's creating a hazardous condition for a child, this is substantially more dangerous conduct than contributing. Mm-hmm.
And so, this is the thrust of this statute, which makes sense, is sort of moving out of the Sergeant DeGraff area of expertise back into the sort of real world, where you're basically grooming children for sex offenses by showing them pornography. It's
correct. My hunch is that it happens more in Sergeant DeGraff's world, but that doesn't stop a babysitter from bringing over a DVD and start grooming the child by showing them adult pornography.
Senator Wilikowski.
Well, you have the provision in here on line 15, section 8, that being 18 years of age or older, and you hear all these stories now about kids sending things to other kids, and is that addressed at all in Alaska law? If a 17-year-old sends a lewd depiction to another 17-year-old, is that...
By telephone, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Through the chair, it would be handled by the juvenile courts, being under 18.
But is there a separate law? Because we specifically have here a person being 18 years of age or older. So would they be, is there a provision in that in Alaska law?
Would the 17-year-old be covered? Is that the question for
right.
the chair? I'll have to take a look at that. We have argued in the past that juveniles were covered under the sexual assault statutes, sexual abuse of minor statutes when they were offenders, and I think we prevailed. And I'll have to go back and compare that, and I'll get back to you on that issue.
Further questions? And so I guess it's never been a crime in Alaska law to groom a child by showing the child pornography? Is that,
Mr.
Zabadny?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct.
Okay. Mm. Yeah. That's an oversight. And remind me what level of offense this is. I'm going to guess C felony. I think I looked that up before the hearing, but I just want to make sure we're making a good record.
C felony, what page?
The top of 5.
Top of page 5.
128C. I see. Yep, thank you.
And then, Mr. Chair, we do have one final section that deals with child pornography, and that is section 16, which is found at page 8, line 1. The federal law prohibits the continuing distribution of child pornography in the criminal justice system by it requiring either law enforcement or the prosecution to hold the evidence and not provide it to the defendant or his attorney. That doesn't mean they don't get access to it to defend their case, but it's not the DA's office burning a CD and giving out the pictures that we've received from Sergeant DeGraff to the defense. This is a change in Criminal Rule 16, which doesn't that restricts more the distribution of child pornography. This is the federal law. It matches the federal law. I don't know how much it happens in this state. I'm not part of that attorney-client discussion between the defendant and his attorney. I can tell you it offends me mightily that when and not in the child pornography section, I find out that the defendants are out there looking at pictures of the victims that they killed. I know that goes on. I've been personally involved in cases where that's happened. It concerns me now that in providing discovery to the defense attorney, they give a copy of the DVD or CD to the defendant, and it ends up in the jail, in the computer, and all other people out of the jail are viewing it. I'm not saying to you that's happened with child pornography, and I know, for example, that the public defender this office often says, we don't want it, you keep it, well, we need to come and look, that's fine. But certainly with other types of disturbing pictures, they're floating around a lot of places, and when we're dealing with child pornography, we want to control the distribution as much as possible.
Let's turn. We're about out of time, but on this point, while we've got Mr. Steiner on the line, let's just turn to him. Quinton, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman.
And if you've been following the discussion, you know we're talking about discovery of child pornography to the defense, and I wanted to get your views on that while we're on this point.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Those kinds of images are something we don't disclose. We certainly don't provide copies to clients. There are occasions when they need to be viewed either by a client for certain reasons or by an expert who's a defense expert. And generally speaking, there's agreements that we have with the state to transfer that material to an expert. Mr. Sabatini's right, we tend to not take possession of this material unless there's a case-specific reason to. The one issue that might come up with this would be the expense related to this discovery limitation. In the cases covered by Section 41.455, we'd have to fly up experts and whatever equipment they needed to do their work wherever the state wanted them to do their work, and that could be relatively expensive because it only applies to 41.455. It may be limited, but that is my one concern with it, because the experts that do this tend to be out of state generally.
Thank you. Anything further on that point?
No. Thank you.
Sergeant DeGraff, thanks so much for being here. We're about out of time. It looks like we're wrapping up. Really appreciate the work you do and the help you bring to this bill for us in understanding the modern complexities of this scourge. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we will stand in adjournment.